coming up on Weekend America.
If you don't keep up on, say, news or ideas, why are you deciding the fate of the country?
A much better ethos would be stop encouraging people to vote if they don't know what's going on.
Most Americans are pretty ill-informed. Should the opinion of the ignorant count as much as that of the well-read? I'm John Moe. Also this hour, the psychology of torture from the point of view of its practitioners.
You have to watch these prisoners. They're the reason why you're in the damn country. You know, they screwed up, whatever else. They're the reason you're tired. They're the reason you're hungry. They're the reason you're thirsty. They're the reason, you know, you're miserable.
Okay, there's more than politics and war on this show, I promise. There's also fall color.
The real beauty is when you can look up close at the leaves, too, and you can see the wonderful patterns of color along the veins and that combination of red and yellows that they show.
Something to think about while raking. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. We're going to make sure you're informed and that you get some things to think about this hour. Election, war, even God at one point. But let me ask you this. Where are you right now? Because for many people on the weekend, the answer is the garage. Changing your oil, tidying up, puttering, futzing, tinkering about. Well, we're going to talk to a guy this hour, a guy in New Jersey, who's gone to a level that's about 100 degrees beyond tinkering, way out of the league of futzing. He has built this ultimate turbo garage of the gods. It makes big, fancy garages seem like those aluminum sheds you buy at the hardware store. It's crazy. What's in your dream garage?
I would definitely put a car that I would want, which is a little red convertible.
I would want a Ferrari inside.
Storage. Lots and lots and lots of storage.
I would also want a DJ set.
A pottery studio.
Maybe put a second level for a jacuzzi.
There would be an infinite number of percussion instruments, gongs and vibraphones and drums and everything.
And I would want music blaring every time I open my garage door.
Man, I just want somewhere to put my lawnmower. Those people have given it a lot of thought. Those voices came from San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Fairbanks, Alaska. So, are you getting ready for Election Day? Are you poring over the voter guides, fact-checking candidate claims, reading the op-eds to get a variety of viewpoints? Are you getting informed? Well, if you are, you are different from most Americans. Here are some scary statistics for you. Only 2 out of 5 Americans can name the 3 branches of the federal government. Only 1 in 7 can find Iraq on a map. And a majority don't know the name of their congressman. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark is a big fan of democracy. But after hearing facts like these, she started to get a little bit nervous about Election Day.
The conventional wisdom is that our democracy can handle all the ignorance. Political scientists find solace in a little thing called the miracle of aggregation, or what I call the coin toss theory. Take a coin, toss it in the air over and over again, and half the time it'll land heads, half the time tails. The coin toss theory says ignorant voters work pretty much the same way. Their votes are random, but evenly divided, which means they cancel each other out. So even if 90% of voters have no idea what they're talking about, it doesn't matter. The 10% who are thoughtful, reasonable, and informed will cast the votes that count. Candidates can focus on them, and democracy is in good hands. There's just one problem with the coin toss theory, according to Rick Schenkman, a historian at George Mason University. Ignorant voters don't actually flip coins. Instead, to mix metaphors,
ignorant voters are sitting ducks.
And perfect targets for political trickery. Rick, who is the author of the subtly titled book Just How Stupid Are We, argues that uninformed voters are not divided 50-50 on one side or the other. They're up for grabs, practically begging to be taken advantage of.
I have yet to meet a politician who, when tempted, won't wind up using some myth to try to provoke a response from the audience.
And the next thing you know, you've got terrorists in living rooms, rumors over book burnings, or more benign myths, the rags-to-riches candidate, the hero. They all play on our passions, not our reason.
I hate to sound like a 19th century schoolmarm, but you know what? It is not asking too much of Americans to spend 5 or 6 minutes a day taking one big issue on the front page of the paper, read it all the way through, clear through to the end, even if it ends on page 38, everybody can be an informed voter. And that's what I want us to do.
A much better ethos would be stop encouraging people to vote if they don't know what's going on.
Economist Brian Kaplan has a slightly more extreme strategy when it comes to the question of voter ignorance. He's the author of the book, The Myth of the Rational Voter.
Right now, if you want to become a U.S. citizen and vote, you have to pass a test of civic knowledge. I don't see why Americans shouldn't have to pass the same test that they give to naturalized citizens.
Brian's quick to point out he wouldn't want voting rights to hinge on race or gender or income, just being well-informed.
And of course, if you take a look at the test, you realize probably most Americans could not pass it.
So I'm standing at the corner of 16th Street and Potrero in San Francisco at a bus stop, and I figured I would check in with people here about how much they know about how the U.S. government works.
Excuse me, I'm a reporter for...
Everyone I talk to here says they're planning to vote in this election, so I start the question. First, what's the main philosophical difference between Republicans and Democrats? A few guesses. Only one person gets close. I move on to geography.
Okay,
one guy can show me where Iraq is on the blank world map I pull out. Most can't find the USA.
Right there.
That's actually Africa right there.
Next up, public affairs.
Roe
versus Wade was a big subject in the presidential
What's
debate
the
this week, so I ask them to explain
Wade?
What it is.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Roe versus Wade. I can't help you with that one.
Are they politicians or just what?
At this point, I'm thinking a voting test doesn't sound like such a bad idea. And then something interesting happens. When I tell people what Roe v. Wade actually means...
It's a Supreme Court decision about abortion and whether to legalize it or not. Does that ring a bell?
People at the bus stop, who up until then had been wary of me and bored, snap to attention.
Well, if you ask me about legalizing abortion and stuff, I would say... I don't think it would be a good deal.
What if an 8-year-old raped and she gets pregnant from someone who she didn't have a choice, but she had her menstruation cycle early, and she has to carry a child, which she is a child herself, and she's had her childhood raped from her.
She still have no right to take that child's life.
A debate erupts. It's heartening to see such civic engagement at a bus stop. Most people don't exactly pass the civic knowledge test, but people definitely have opinions. Who knows if they're based on facts or myths? And that's the tricky question. How do you gauge someone's political IQ? Here's Rick Schenkman again, the historian who calls ignorant voters sitting ducks.
I think it would be too divisive to have a civic literacy test. I don't want to exclude people.
Especially given the historic bloody fights many Americans have had to wage over the years to get the right to vote. But Rick says people should know enough about history and civics
so that we can at least have a conversation. You know, and that is what democracy is all about, is having a conversation.
It can make waiting for your bus a lot more interesting. And it's not so bad for the future of the country. In San Francisco, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
And by the way, the three branches of government are executive, legislative, and judicial, and Republicans traditionally favor less government than Democrats. You're welcome.
68 was like an earthquake.
The country was not on the cusp of revolution.
There appeared to be as many policemen as demonstrators.
But it was certainly on the cusp of some enormous millennial change.
Now we hear you loud and clear, boy.
It still does resonate even when people don't realize that it's resonating.
We continue our series now, focusing on 1968 and what resonates from 40 years ago. Our lives are pretty different today from 40 years ago, and political advertising is different as well. The production values are more slick, there's online ads, there's email solicitations. But while political ads may have evolved, they've stayed more similar than you might think over the last 40 years. Here's a review of more than 80 political ads since 1968.
This is about the White House.
I'm John McCain.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Time has come for the American people to turn to new leadership.
Vote.
Not tied to the policies and mistakes of the past.
President Ford.
McGovern.
Humphrey Muskie.
Jimmy Carter. Bob
Dole. Reagan.
Do we want to go on as we have with more of the same?
You don't call that maverick. You call it more of the same.
I, George Marker West, do solemnly swear.
They'll change Washington. McCain, Palin. Real change that works for working families. Al
Gore. Jimmy Carter. A leader for
change. Change this country. I'm John Kerry, and that's why I approved this message.
Together we can hardly fail, for there is no force on earth to match the will and spirit of the people of America. trust in government.
New era of economic greatness in America.
For a new America.
The President of the United States.
Jimmy Carter, a military man, and a man of
peace with freedom.
To preserve our peace and our freedom, we must maintain a margin of safety. History has taught us only too well.
To win the peace.
The tyrants are tempted only when the forces of freedom are weak.
And weakness attracts those who are waiting to do America harm.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
Does a president know that planes bomb children?
I hate war. And I know how terrible its costs are.
The time has come for the American people to turn to new leadership, not tied to the policies and mistakes of the past. I pledge to you, we shall have an honorable end to the war in Vietnam.
Nixon now, more than ever, Nixon now.
What if there was hope instead of fear?
I think there's a lot of cynicism today in America.
Do we participate in a politics of cynicism, or do we participate in a politics of hope?
I'm going to run a campaign that is hopeful and optimistic and very positive.
This is about...
I'm John McCain, and I approve this message.
A lot of Californians feel pretty good about Ronald Reagan, but others feel a sense of continuing concern.
He shoots from the hip.
I think he's the kind of guy who shoots from the hip.
This is about credibility.
And I approve this message.
Ever notice what happens to Nixon when the political winds blow?
John Kerry, whichever way the wind blows.
Which way will he blow next?
This is about dishonesty.
Willie Horton.
This is about lying.
Politicians lying about their records. You don't call that maverick. You call it more of the same.
This is about sabotage.
Obama and congressional liberals. Too risky for America.
This is about the White House.
It's about our America. It's not my America. It's your America.
Vote on November 4th. Vote like your whole world depended on it.
I'm Barack Obama.
I'm John McCain.
And I approve this message.
That 40-year review of political ads was produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler. You can check out some of those ads on our website. We got a Jimmy Carter ad from 1980 and a Richard Nixon ad from 1968. And I'm really sorry that you're going to spend this whole weekend singing, Nixon now, Nixon now. It's stuck in your head. I'm sorry. Check it all out at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
How the abuse of prisoners in Iraq led to the death of an American soldier back home. Coming up on Weekend America. Thank you. It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe. The group Iraq Veterans Against the War is holding what are called Winter Soldier events in Portland, Oregon, and in Baltimore today. They're protesting treatment of detainees in Iraq and Afghanistan. The name Winter Soldier comes from a 1971 protest by American soldiers home from the Vietnam War. The issue then, as now, was torture and the role of the American military in the practice of torture. Joshua Phillips just produced a new documentary with American Radio Works called What Killed Sergeant Gray. It focuses on the effect of torture on the torturers. Joshua Phillips, tell me about Sergeant Gray.
Sergeant Gray was a tanker with Battalion 168. He did a tour in Iraq during 2003-2004. He survived the war, but when he came home, his family and friends noticed that he was deeply troubled. In 2004, he was found dead in his barracks in Fort Wainwright, Alaska, and friends and family wondered if it was a suicide or if it was a drug overdose or if it had anything to do with experiences in Iraq that he was still grappling with. His mother, Cindy Chavez, was someone who noticed that when he came back, he looked, as she called it, troubled.
He would get this glazed look over him, and we'd be in a discussion, and his eyes would literally get glassy, and he would just disconnect. And you know he was back there.
What had happened to him in Iraq?
He was involved in a shooting incident in which he and members of his tank opened fire on what they thought was a small group of insurgents, and it ended up being a small family. And two of the three members of that family ended up dying, one of whom was a little girl. That was deeply troubling to him. But the experience of detainee abuse, of being involved in abusing detainees, Iraqi detainees, was also something in which he told his mother deeply troubled him.
Oh, I can't even imagine how you couldn't be. Because when Adam was telling me the story and it was graphic, I told him, I said, I can't even listen to this. And he's like, well, Mom, we were ordered to do that. And I'm like, I understand that, but this is too crazy. Then how can you bend people's minds like that? And then shoot you back in the States and say, hey, go be a family man. No, it's so many ways of wrong.
What did you learn from Sergeant Gray's battalion about what went on in Iraq?
They were mostly involved in sleep deprivation, forcing detainees not to sleep for long periods of the day and night by blasting loud music into their ears, forcing them to do straining physical exercises, forced positions. All this stuff is really prevalent in the sort of categories of a detainee abuse that U.S. troops had been involved with. But some of the troops we interviewed were also involved in water torture, where they were pinning down detainees and pouring water into their mouths and noses. And some of them were involved in mock executions.
Let's hear how Tony Sandoval, who is one of Sergeant Gray's closest friends, described the troops' attitude toward detainees.
You have to watch these prisoners, and they're the reason why you're in the damn country. You know, they screwed up, whatever else. They're the reason you're tired. They're the reason you're hungry. They're the reason you're thirsty. They're the reason, you know, you're miserable. And here you have to babysit them. And so sometimes if they wouldn't shut up, you'd say, all right, just start doing push-ups or getting, you know, some physical position or something. You know, it's not like I've ever seen any guys go in and tell them to get naked and stack up on each other. I think that's gross. You know, none of us were that stupid. But there was other times when you wanted to pull out a pistol and put it to the back of their head. And, you know, everyone had that sort of tension. And it was very uncomfortable and it was miserable.
So they had done these things in Iraq. What did that do to these guys who had been doing this torturing?
I would say, first of all, not everyone who was involved in detainee abuse was traumatized because of it. And from the little research that's been done on this subject, that is not uncommon. You know, not everyone has the same response to their involvement with torture and detainee abuse. And the extent to which they feel guilt or shame directly correlates with the extent to which they are traumatized and have PTSD and other similar conditions. But across the board, I would say, almost all of the men that we interviewed said they experienced some degree of PTSD. Some described attempted suicides. Many of them talked about having hair trigger tempers, getting into fights, having divorces, substance abuse, being edgy. The list goes on and on. Jonathan Lance was an Army medic who saw and even participated in, as he says, many of the abuses.
It's very hard. It's hard to deal with. I mean, that's why I was kind of reluctant to do this interview to begin with, because, I mean, I'm going to be thinking about this for a while, because I do not like talking about it. You two people are the only souls in this world who I talk to about this. It's very hard, and yeah, I had a breakdown last time afterwards.
When Abu Ghraib came to light, the explanation that was given was that this was a few bad apples acting alone.
Right, the few bad apples argument. Okay, well, no one takes the few bad apples explanation seriously anymore. It is just not a credible explanation. There has been ample documentation of U.S. prisoner abuse in Afghanistan and Iraq. And even the military has acknowledged that there have been hundreds of reported cases of detainee abuse. For social scientists and experts on torture, it's not the case of a few bad apples. It is organizational pressures. It is the conditions that enable troops to engage in detainee abuse and torture. One of those experts is Darius Rajali, who's the author of Torture and Democracy. He explains some of the conditions by which troops become involved in detainee abuse and torture.
Most of us, given the right set of incentives, would torture. That is the evidence of almost 40 years of social psychological research. It's the situation, not the disposition, that leads us to torture.
Well, Joshua, if that's the case, that most people will do this given the right circumstances, what has the military done to prevent more situations like what Sergeant Gray and his unit were involved with, abusing the prisoners that they were guarding?
Generally, by and large, the military has been taking more aggressive measures to tamp down on detainee abuse. However, you know, there's still some reports that it continues. And frankly, one of the problems that I find very troubling is that mid-level officers have not had any sort of serious accountability. That is, even though the military has reported on several hundred cases of detainee abuse cases, there has not been a lot of serious punishment for these cases, not been a lot of serious follow-through on whistleblower cases and so forth. And I think until that's done, you know, you're not ensuring that there is a full check on detainee abuse.
Joshua Phillips produced the documentary What Killed Sergeant Gray, along with Michael Montgomery of American Radio Works. You can find more about the effects of torture on the perpetrators at our website. You can hear that documentary there as well, weekinamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA program.
All the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. Wait a second, why are all the leaves brown? And why are some of them orange or yellow or red? Mysteries of Autumn solved, ahead on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, this is Week in America. I'm John Moe. Well, you'll be heading into a voting booth soon, if you haven't already voted from home, that is, and you'll declare who you think would lead the country most effectively. You'll take a leap of faith, you might say. Well, this fall, we've been asking people to bring us their take on what's important for them as they prepare to cast that vote. We're calling it Conversations with America, and our essay today comes from Colorado author Lindsay O'Connor, and it's all about faith.
I asked friends and family what their main election issue was. Unions, said one friend. Her husband is an airline pilot. Another friend's issue is stem cell research. He has multiple sclerosis. I care about foreign relations. I choke at the gas pump like everyone else, and I'm trying not to panic about the worldwide economic nightmare. But I wasn't clear what issue most mattered to me and why. I found myself sifting through two mental snapshots and a deathbed scene. Snapshot one. I'm 9 years old, sitting at my grandparents' breakfast table. My grandfather rants about the no-do-gooders in Washington, who are all a bunch of crooks. He pounds his fist on the table. His eggs quiver. His clean coveralls still smell of machine shop oil. It's about time they do something for the working man, he bellows. My grandmother ignores him. She doesn't care at all for politics, yet she adores JFK. His face shines down from a china plate on the wall. I think he must be a king, or a relative, or both. Snapshot two. I'm a little older, about 10. I'm with my other grandmother at her breakfast table. Another face shines down from the wall. My grandma says he's a king and a relative. This one's a picture of Jesus. Before we eat the homemade biscuits, she prays like she knows him. Deathbed scene. I am 41 years old. The deathbed is mine, only I don't know it. A routine hospital procedure goes terribly wrong. I'm in a coma. A ventilator breathes for me. A feeding tube nourishes me. My husband agonizes about turning off life support that's been keeping me alive for weeks. He signs a do not resuscitate order, then rescinds it. His core beliefs smack up against a decision with no room for error. Being on the wrong end of life support is no time to figure out where you stand on how to live out the sanctity of life. When I first heard this, I said to my husband, "You did what?" Later, I scrounged through the Bible like a starving woman. I consumed the words of old sermons and ethics books and medical journals. I roughed up my knees in prayer, trying to square my beliefs with real end-of-life choices. My grandfather, with his working man rants, showed me how I could be personally affected by politics. My grandmother, with her China JFK plate, taught me to have an opinion about the man in office. My other grandmother, praying before we shared a meal, modeled a relationship with God. And my own story, with my husband at my deathbed, showed me that believing in something can be easy, but applying that faith is sometimes the hardest thing we ever do. Some people vote lockstep. I've done it before. People looking to their pastor or the Catholic Church or the media for a voting cheat sheet. But for me, what's different in this election is the effort of my thinking. It's not about the candidate who shares my religion. It's not about a single deal-breaker issue. It's not even what the candidates say about faith. What is important to me is thinking deeply about my faith. I need to know my core beliefs and how I want to act on them. And I want to measure the candidates in the same way. I want to see what they've done with what they say they believe, how they vote. Why? Why is faith so important to me? Why is applying it my issue? Simple. I love God. Heart, mind, soul, strength. For me, trying to live out my faith is everything. Figuring out my beliefs and how I want to apply them helps me figure out my vote. Then voting becomes an act of faith.
Lindsay O'Connor is author of If Mama Ain't Happy, Ain't Nobody Happy. You can find out more about her and read other essays in our conversation series. That's all at our website, weekendamerica.org. While you're there, drop us a line and become part of the conversation, too.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. If you're in a part of the country dominated by coniferous trees, you know needles instead of leaves, this time of year is no big deal. It's getting colder, so what? But if your landscape features deciduous trees, it is technicolor outside. Here in the upper Midwest, with all of our oaks and maples, it is like someone lit the city on fire, but, you know, in a good way. But why do the leaves change color? What's actually happening to these trees? We're going to get all educational here for a minute. Weekend America producer Ocean Kalin headed out with a real live scientist to try to understand what's going on inside the leaf.
I grew up in western Massachusetts, the epicenter for fall colors. I used to spend a lot of time just walking through the woods and watching nature and lying on the ground, feeling the maple leaves fall on me as the wind blew, and just being almost like a snow angel in the leaves and moving my arms and my legs back and forth and feeling that rustling of the dry leaves and watching the colors come down through the blue sky.
Can you start by telling me your name?
Sure. I'm Bud Marquardt, and I'm on the faculty of the University of Minnesota, Department of Horticultural Science. We're in the Como Conservatory Gardens. We're having a beautiful day under a bright blue sky here and enjoying the colors of the park. Yeah, the science behind it is the yellows come from pigments called anthocyanin and carotenoids. And those are pigments that are there in the leaves all the time. We just can't see them because the leaves have so much chlorophyll and the plants are actively photosynthesizing and the chlorophyll dominates.
Okay, so hold
the
on.
Yellows.
Okay, okay. So we've got three things here. We've got chlorophyll, which I've heard before.
Okay, chlorophyll.
And then the two other things?
Right. The chlorophyll is the green pigment. And then in addition to that, we have the yellow pigments, which are called carotenoids and or xanthophylls.
Okay, and what are they good for? Okay. Why do they exist?
Yeah, they're there all the time to protect the chlorophyll so that it's not damaged by too much sun or stressful conditions. When a leaf is photosynthesizing, I mean, it's a really high-energy process. There's all this sunlight coming in, and it's exciting all of these electrons, and these electrons are going around and trying to make food. And, boy, if there's too much energy, those excited electrons can cause a lot of damage. If you take a bunch of teenagers and put them in a room with nothing to do, boy, look out. They're going to start raising a lot of heck. And that's what all these electrons will do, too. And it's the carotenoids and the xanthophylls that help keep those electrons sort of kind of under control and give them some place to go so that they don't cause a lot of damage.
So these are just little things that are in the leaf that are sort of doing their job maintaining, and they just happen to have a color to them?
Right, and they happen to have a color. When they know that it's time to take all that energy out of the leaves and put it into the root systems, first thing that they do is they break down all of the chlorophyll molecules. That's because the chlorophyll has a lot of important nutrients and resources in there. So when it gets rid of the chlorophyll, what's left is the xanthophylls and the carotenoids. And that's why we get yellow color. One of the real mysteries is exactly what is the biochemical mechanism by which plants sense that shortening of the day.
So just the most basic trigger of when it's time to change color. We don't know?
We understand some of the mechanisms, I'd say. We just don't have a full picture yet. We know it's a change in day length, but we don't know exactly how that change in day length is transformed into all of the changes that need to take place to change the colors.
I find that amazing. When we think of mysteries in science, we think of water on Mars or, you know, what life forms are in the deep sea.
Uh-huh.
But in our own backyard, we don't entirely know what's going on.
That's right. That's right. There's still a lot of wonderful mystery that's out there. It's why plant physiologists or horticulturalists still have jobs, because there's still a lot for us to discover.
Bud Marquardt teaches organic horticulture and tries to solve the mystery of his own backyard at the University of Minnesota. He spoke with Weekend America producer Ocean Kalin. Well, are you doing some chores this weekend? Maybe trying to rake up those mysterious leaves? Maybe washing the car? Perhaps doing the most dreaded chore of all? Are you bracing yourself here? Cleaning out the garage? It's the worst, isn't it? Well, for some people, it's not. There is a type of American for whom the garage is so much more than a place to store junk or cars or junked out cars. For them, the garage is a haven, a wonderland, Garage Valhalla. For the last 4 years, Kevin Felici has been working nights and weekends in a quest for the perfect garage, a garage free of chaos and full of magic. Laura Spiro went to Emerson, New Jersey to talk with Kevin and his very patient wife, Gail.
Kevin Felici's garage is nothing like yours.
It's 40 feet deep, 30 feet wide. It's got a 60,000 BTU heater, hot and cold water sink. It's got an enclosed toilet.
Did we rip down how many trees?
Yes, there were six large trees, approximately 60 feet in height, where the garage now stands. They had to come down.
And a 10-foot rhododendron that the deer love to go potty behind.
Cable, phone lines, internet. This is what I call a high-end garage, because there's been no expense spared doing what I've done in here. The garage, as you see it, actually cost me more than the house did.
The birth of this masterpiece can be traced back to sometime during the 34 years that Kevin spent doing radio ops in the military.
I started out in the Pentagon. Then I went to Bowling Air Force Base, then I went to Andrews Air Force Base, then when I got out of active duty, I went...
He moved around a lot. It would be hard for anyone to feel settled.
You know, you always think about the things you'd like to have. Think about where you can put things, what you can do with things. And like I said, I've always wanted a garage. All the houses I've ever had, never had a garage.
Just a few years ago, Kevin finally got the opportunity to make his fantasy real. But it didn't happen in a way he could ever have expected. And definitely not in a way he would have wanted.
Actually, he was in Italy when the towers came down. And when he came home, the first thing that happened was, now you're assigned, and you're going to ground zero.
Kevin spent 7 months on active duty after 9/11, and his service provided a financial boost that allowed him to start building. Now, at the beginning, he had no intention of building an extremo garage.
Basically a box is what I would have built.
But once he got started, one thing led to another.
And then it just kind of developed.
It developed. I went top of the end with everything. I just got crazy with myself. 24 feet of cabinets, upper and lower.
But if I had the cabinets, then it has to be space that you can open the cabinet doors without hitting a car.
I'm very, very meticulous about my cars.
And I want to be able to put a snowblower in and my motorcycle in.
This is 3/4-inch tongue and groove plywood, 16-inch on center. This is like solid. The inside, the outside, vacuum, clean.
Well, if I'm going to be out there, I want a television.
It's also three separate sets of lighting in here, so you don't turn them all at one time. If you're working in the back of the garage, you turn this switch on. The middle of the garage, turn that one on. The front, you turn this on.
He bought a special mop for the garage.
Gail's actually a really good sport, and she and Kevin have a fair deal. She wanted the outside of the garage to match the house, so with the red cedar shake and peaked roof line in place, she's happy to turn the inside over to her husband.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The outside's the outside. The inside's mine.
I kind of knew from the beginning it was a guy thing. This is his space. It's white, gray, and black. It's man colors.
Guys would go, this is a garage. Oh, my God, this is a garage. This is a dream. If I could ever have it, this is what I would have. It's going to have surround sound, too. And quite a few people that say, you know, what are you going to do with this garage? I said, I don't know what I'm going to do in this garage.
He doesn't know what he's going to do with this garage. Yeah, after all that effort.
Well, aren't you going to work on cars? No. What I would love to do is get the computer out here, get everything cataloged in the computer, so that if I need sandpaper, I go to the computer and say, sandpaper, and it tells me it's in cabinet 3, shelf 2.
There's a word, putz. He can come out here and putz around. All I ask is that he put an intercom in, because I don't want to have to call his cell phone when I'm in the house going, your mother's on the phone, pick up the phone.
Which is also cabled for. I have everything.
Kevin's garage isn't about doing things. It's about having a place to put things. It's a huge indulgence, and he knows that.
I spent a lot of time overseas, and to see where some of these people live, you know, and to think about a garage like this, it's very, very selfish. But
as a daydream and escape?
Yes, exactly. You know, the ultimate, would I like to have it someday?
We're talking maximum potential.
That's it. You know, it's no building a car or building a box or building a, you know, a cabinet. I just want to have the opportunity that if I want to do something, I can do it out here.
And when he does need a hammer, it's going to be really easy to get to in Cabinet 21 on Shelf 8. In Emerson, New Jersey, I'm Laura Spiro for Weekend America.
It wasn't very large. There was just enough room to cram the drums in the corner.
Check out photos of Kevin's garage at weekendamerica.org. Now, your garage is not as magnificent as Kevin's, we can stipulate that, but even modest garages can be a place for that other side of our lives. The inventor's studio, the art gallery, the theater, especially good for theater if you get the car out of the way, unless your play takes place in a car. I digress. We want to hear stories about your garage life. What project is awaiting completion there on the cold cement floor? How is your garage making your dreams come true? Tell us your story at weekendamerica.org. We 65 and sunny for Barack Obama's event in Kansas City today. John McCain gets clouds and 62 in Concord, North Carolina. For a look at some nonpartisan fun and weather, here's Jeannie Yandel.
Hedgeballs are fruits that look like green tennis ball-sized brains, and they'll be flying everywhere during Eureka, Kansas's Hedgeball Chuckin' Festival. Grab your air cannons and catapults, they're allowed. 72 and sunny for chuckin' hedgeballs and craft vendors who will hopefully be showing their wares inside a huge bunker of some kind. Also, a climbing wall, which either means hedgeballs are really soft or the people of Eureka just don't like each other. Given Yogi Bear's penchant for picnic baskets, it seems like getting him near bags and bags of Halloween candy is an awful idea. Yet Cave City, Kentucky's Jellystone Park is pushing Yogi's limits during its Halloween weekend. 63 and sunny for trick-or-treating, cartoon bear attacks, camping, and costume contests. Outdoor cooking is also encouraged, which frankly just seems like adding insult to injury. Poor Yogi. Rutting season is when male moose pick fights with each other as part of mating rituals. And it's when Grand Marais, Minnesota decides to get in a lonely, angry moose's business during moose madness. Cloudy and 52 for moose sighting trips, moose trivia, and a moose poetry salon. Take a picture with mascot Murray the Moose, also known as the bravest person ever for dressing up like a moose during rutting season. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
A string quartet busts out of the concert hall and travels the country working with folk musicians. Do Birkenstocks go with this tuxedo? Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. New York City has plenty of options for musical entertainment this weekend and every day. It can be overwhelming, in fact. Do you want to hear classical music or perhaps some folky accordion? If you go over to the Brooklyn Academy of Music, however, you don't have to decide. There's a performance there called Ethel's Truck Stop, The Beginning, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and reporter Jeff London tells us about it.
Ethel is not a person. It's a string quartet. And usually, Ethel sounds like this. Over the last 10 years, Ethel's built a reputation as an edgy, intense downtown New York ensemble, kind of more band than string quartet. And the Juilliard-trained group has been known to kick back and play rock, blues, and jazz, in addition to modern classical compositions. Still, what are they doing playing music that sounds like this? That's Ethel playing with San Antonio-based Conjunto accordionist Ava Ibarra. She's one of the four folk musicians they're working with on their new show, Truck Stop. According to director Annie Dorson,
this project is about cultural collision, peaceful collision, but collision nonetheless.
Ethel spends a lot of time on the road, and a few years ago, they decided they wanted to stop and get to know some local musicians in the communities where they were playing. And Truck Stop was born.
Oh, boy, we had a year of fabulous experiences with the four artists that we're presenting at BAM.
Dorothy Lawson is Ethel's cellist. She says the quartet had week-long truck stops, artistic residencies, across the country, getting to know professional folk musicians, listening to their music, listening to their stories, and vice versa.
The universal experience is delight in the sharing, incredible curiosity of what each other's lives are like, what we each use music to express.
Ethel traveled to Hawaii to work with slack key guitarist Jeff Peterson, who's featured on this track. They traveled to New Mexico to work with Robert Mirabal, a Native American musician.
He builds flutes, gorgeous, gorgeous flutes, and he also understands and uses Native percussion very, very skillfully, and he sings, and he's used to contributing from those colors, even to a completely unrelated art form.
While each performance of Truck Stop will showcase the folk artists playing solos, the heart of the piece will be the music they've all created together with Ethel. After residencies in their communities, Ethel brought the four musicians together for a workshop. Director Annie Dorson says she wanted them to think outside the box. For instance, she asked bluegrass banjo player Dean Osborne,
"Can you do something with a banjo that no one who plays banjo would ever do? You know, is there some sound that it can make, but that it shouldn't make or that it wouldn't normally make?"
And Dean Osborne jumped at the opportunity. He says he's found the process of working with musicians from widely divergent traditions both fascinating and ear-opening.
In finding that common ground, you have to go away from your comfort zone. When you write original music, you know, you're not in a comfortable place. You're in a place where you're stretched to things that maybe you've never played before, you've only heard, or maybe you never thought about playing, but Then all of a sudden you hear that sound next to the sound of a flute, or next to the sound of the accordion, or next to the sound of the guitar, or next to the sound of these beautiful strings. And you realize it immediately once it happens, but getting to that place where it happens is a long journey, and it's a very special time for all of us.
Dorothy Lawson says one of her favorite parts of Truck Stop is when the quartet lays out and the four collaborators play a piece they created themselves.
I think that's maybe the most fascinating moment in the show for me because, of course, they had no earlier impulse to come together. There would have been nothing bringing them together apart from this particular project, and they've taken it on.
Regardless of how this experimental mashup of musical styles works out in Brooklyn, Dorothy Lawson says Ethel has already lined up further truck stops with folk musicians in places as far-flung as Holland and Tasmania.
It is going to be an ongoing mission for us to find a way to work inside of a community wherever we go.
In New York, I'm Jeff London for Weekend America.
We have photos of Ethel and its truck stop partners. That's all at our website. Also, we want to hear about your weekend soundtrack. We've been doing that many weeks on our program, and we want to hear from you. We haven't heard from you yet. What's the song that gets you through the weekend? Either the song that you're listening to every weekend lately, or maybe a tune that you remember from a weekend long ago that brings up some kind of memory. We want to hear the stories behind it. We want to play the song for all of America. If you go to our website, you can find a link. It's on the upper right-hand side of the page. It says, "What's Your Weekend Soundtrack?" That's all at weekendamerica.org. And that does it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. You can download a free podcast of the entire program at weekendamerica.org. It's also available at iTunes. I hope you have a wonderful weekend, whether you're out there trying to solve the mysteries of your leaves, or trying to build the perfect garage, or perhaps making some campaign ads of your own. You can do that now, I guess. Everybody can do that with the YouTube and the internets and the Googles. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Want to get frightened out of your wits in half a minute or less? I'm John Moe. On the next Weekend America, 30-second tales of terror from writers like David Rakoff.
I don't go to scary movies. I'm easily scared by them, so I've actually avoided them my whole life. I don't go on roller coasters, all that sort of stuff. So I was trying to think of the things that seemed terrifying in daily life.
You'll want to hear what he came up with. Weekend America, it's coming from inside your house. Join us.